I'd now like to introduce our speaker, Johnny H. John?
You'll notice that they took the money up first. Hi, everybody. My name is Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very glad to be here tonight. Sober? I'm extremely pleased to be here fully clothed and in my right mind. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. And I don't say it to make any sense to anybody. It seems like the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more necessary it becomes for me to remember from whence I came. And I don't ever want to forget that 21 years ago, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary. And because of a loving God who has expressed himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. If I didn't get anything out of this deal at all, I think I could live with that for a long, long time. It just kind of warms me, just the knowledge of what it was and where I am. If I'm made tonight, I'd like to tell you how I got to where I was 21 years ago. I worked at it. You don't just show up there someday and say, let me in, coach. This is what I'm striving for. I've been training for this all my life. No, what I was doing crawling around on that floor, barking at the moon, is about what I was doing. I was looking for something. And to make matters even worse, I didn't know what it was I was looking for. But whatever it was, I didn't have it. Now, that's something I've known all my life. I've known that from my earliest recollection of life, that there was something the matter with me. Now, I didn't know what it was. There was just something wrong with me. I just wasn't right. It was just, I was just different than they were. I wasn't like they were. I didn't feel like them, and I didn't want to be around them, and I hated all of them, and I didn't understand that. I just didn't understand that. I didn't want to be that way. I kept wondering why, and I kept looking for a reason why I felt like that, and I had a built-in excuse right in front of me. I had a drunken mother, a drunken father, four drunken uncles, three drunken aunts, and a drunken grandfather. And I said, well, no wonder I feel different. I've been born beneath my station. I don't belong around these. I belong around them. And, you know, I don't know how you think about it, but it's just common logic with me that there's only bad people and there's only good people. And if I don't belong around the bad people, I must belong around the good people. Makes sense. But I had a tough time finding any good ones. And one day I looked up and there stood my grandmother. And my grandmother was a kindly old lady. She lived till she was 90 years old, never took a drink or smoked a cigarette in her life. And she went to church all the time. And I figured wherever Grandma went, I'd go because that's where the good people hung out. And so I went with Grandmother to church. I never will forget my first morning going to church with my grandmother. We started down the thing in the congregation, met my grandmother. I'm in one hand and my older brother's in the other. And they met and they said, oh, Ella, you're so magnificent. You pack your burdens with such great dignity. And my grandmother smiled and say, yeah, yeah. That was that Al-Anon smile. Yeah. That was before there was Al-Anon, but Grandma knew how to smile like that. Yeah. And they used to say to her, and the Lord will provide. And Grandma would say, yes, yes. And he did. He just kept on loading her down. You know, I didn't understand it. And then we'd go in and sit down in this church. Now, I've left these bad people that I feel different and strange and apart from, these bad folks in life. And I finally got around the good folks, and I go in and sit down there. I feel different, strange, apart from, and I hate all them, too. I said, I wonder what's the matter with me. I don't belong around the bad ones. I don't belong around the good ones. I wonder where I do belong. And then I sit there in that church that morning. And I did something that morning that I did my entire lifetime up to and including a long time after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I sit in that church and waited for one of them quote and unquote superior beings to tell me what was the matter with me. I wanted him to tell me why I had that hole in my gut. I wanted him to tell me why I was different and strange and apart from and not like anybody else. I wanted him to tell me what that great big wall of hatred inside of me that I didn't understand was and what I was supposed to do about it. And you know what he said that morning, that guy in those long flowing robes? He said you're supposed to love and honor and respect your parents. He said you're supposed to love your brothers. And I didn't. I hated them. I hated them for reasons I didn't even understand. And God, I felt guilty about that. And I became frightened to death sitting in that church that people were going to find out I was hating when I was supposed to be loving. And I didn't know what to do about that. You know, I don't belong around the bad folks. I don't belong around the good folks. I go to where all the people are, and the superior person tells them supposed to feel one way and to feel another way. Now I'm really in a lot of trouble. I turned to walk outside the door of the church that day, and my old man standing there drunk and hungover. He reached over and tapped me on the head and said, "Son, if you continue to go to church, you're going to grow up to be just like me." There's a lot of things in life I don't want to be, but my old man was one of them. Because he was a drunk. And I lived in a house where there were two drunks working. And if you haven't ever lived in that type of a nightmare, I'll explain it to you. You see, in a house like that, in the middle of the night, they're screaming and yelling and cussing and flesh hitting flesh and breaking furniture in deathly silence. Every once in a while, the old man come drug me out of bed and start kicking me around. Now, he never did it to my brothers. He just did it to me. And I remember laying there at night with a knife and saying, if he comes tonight, I'm going to stick him. But he doesn't come that night, thank God. He just doesn't come. And I lay there as a kid, and I think about all those things. I think about what goes on in life. I think about why I don't belong here, why I don't belong there, these weird feelings that I don't understand. Why me? Why's all this heel happening? I'm trying to figure out what puts my uncles in them penitentiaries and my aunts in those houses on the other side of the tracks. Try to figure out what makes my old man beat up my mother and my mother beat up my old man. What makes them both beat me up? What makes my grandfather go out there and burn down barns? What makes all these things happen? And I think about it and think about it and think about it. And somewhere way back there, the answer come to me one night. I know what's the problem. It's alcohol. That's what it is, alcohol. I'm not going to drink because I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be better than they are. I'm going to get up and I'm going to step out in that world. I'm going to have something and be something and do something. What do you do if you're weird? What do you do if you've been everywhere there is to go and you've asked all the questions there is to ask and there's any answers? I tell you what I did. I took a drink. There's no big decision on my part. I just took a drink. It was the most fantastic thing that ever happened to me in my life. It went down and just kind of tore the madness out of me. That's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol took me from the black pit of nothingness, stood me on the gray fringes of the business of living, and installed in me a sense of arrogance that says, damn you, world, it's all right. Maybe I'm not good enough to be around the good people, and maybe I'm too good to be around the bad people, but it's okay right here. That's what alcohol did for me. Now I'm going to tell you a strange secret. If alcohol still did that, I'd still drink it. That's as simple as I know how to put it. But alcohol quit doing that a long, long time ago. See, I've always had to have some type of an answer. And I've always had the problem. And the problem's always been there. That's something I know without a shadow of a doubt, because the problem had never been there. I'd never had to put nothing in me to make it okay. I'd like to tell you, during the next 20 years of my life, I discovered some wonderful way to drink alcohol. I never did, because I'm a bad drinker. Well, I'm a hog. Hogs don't drink well. I'm one of them type of people, think what one would do, what would 32 do for you? That's the way I think. I don't know why that is, but that's just the way I think. That's the way weird people think. If it's good, God abuse it. I don't care what it is. Just get it on. You know, that's good. Indulge. That's the way I feel. Now, everybody's not like that. See, every once in a while, I get wrapped up with them Rolaids. And by the time I catch what I'm doing, I don't have gas for 6 months. But that's the way I do things. Now, my sponsor's not like that. He's weird. He come running into the meeting one night. He said, God, I got a headache. And I said, oh. And he said, get me an aspirin. So I ran around and shook down a couple of purses and found two Excedrins. I ran up to him very proud. He held out his hand and put two Excedrins in there. He said, I only want one. I said, take two. You won't have a headache tomorrow. He didn't think that was funny. But I did. I just thought that's the way I think. Now, don't ask me where it goes away, because I don't know. I just don't know. I guess maybe somewhere in that sweet by, in that great escalator in the sky that carries you off into happiness. I guess. I don't know. Because I still think that way. But I'll tell you one thing. I'd hate to be wandering around in the world right now when it gets salty out there with that idea in the back of my mind, plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is. The reason I'm standing here before you tonight, over 20 years in this fellowship without any type of a chemical in my system. And the reason I'm standing here tonight, I'd like to be able to stand here tonight and tell you I've quit drinking and smoking dope and shooting dope and eating them pills. I'd like to be able to tell you I quit doing that. But I had never, right at this moment, ever quit it. It quit me. And I think that's the great blessing that I have in life. Because if it still works, I'd have had to work it. Now, what happened to me when I took my first drink is what happened to people the Chinese wrote about thousands of years ago. I took a drink, the drink took a drink, and then the drink took me. Now, I'd like to tell you, during the next 20 years of my career, about all the families I lost, you got to have some to lose them. I'd like to tell you about all the jobs that I lost, but I never worked. I can tell you about all the schools I got kicked out of, but didn't go to school. When I took my first drink and it did what it did for me, I spent every waking moment of my life for the next 20 years even thinking about one, two things, how to get the money to get loaded on or get loaded. That's all I thought about. And if you pursued your fantasies the way I pursued mine, you didn't have time to work. And they couldn't pay you enough money to make it go anyhow. And that's the way I did things. Now, what happened to me? I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath a bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. I was in that school a little while. My mother came and took me out of that school and brought me to California. On the way to California, my mother said, "We get to California, things are going to be different." Now, I don't know what my brothers thought. I know what I thought. Thought, well, we're going to get out there. We're going to have a little white house and a picket fence. Mom's going to get a little crispy apron with a tray full of cookies and milk. Everything's going to be fine. Bring my friends in the house and say, "This is my mom." That's an alcoholic delusion that over there it's going to be better. Over there. We left a one-room shack in Kansas and came to California and got us a one-room shack with a bathroom. Mama got me a couple of new uncles and introduced them to me. And I went out on the streetcar and got drunk. But I made a fantastic discovery. I found out that alcohol would do the same thing to me in California that it did in Kansas. And in my way of thinking, it was the only thing I'd ever found that ever did the same thing twice in succession. See, I was tired of people telling me things they weren't going to do. I was tired of getting my hopes and dreams and aspirations that high off the ground and having them come along and kick the stool out from underneath me. But I found out if I threw a brick through a window and got a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drank it, it did exactly what I anticipated it doing. It went down in there and tore the madness out of me. It took me from over there and stood me there and gave me that. And I got drunk and went to juvenile hall. I spent the next 3.5 years of my life in juvenile hall in a running court battle with my mother, a lawyer, and a judge. Once a month, I went in front of a judge. He sent me to Whittier State Reform School, and once a month, my mother stood with a lawyer and appealed it. Once a month, my mother came to juvenile hall and visited me and told me strange things, like, "I love you and I miss you. When you come home, things are going to be different." For a long, long time, I didn't buy that because I wasn't about to get kicked around anymore. I'm getting tired of people telling me those things. I'm not going to get kicked around anymore. Somewhere during that 3.5 year period of time, I started to believe my mother. And it was just a little subtle thing. And I guess it's because I wanted so desperately to believe that over there, that alcoholic delusion, that over there is where it is. If I could just put it together over there, then this would get okay. So I went in front of the judge one day, and he told me that they were going to put me in a boys' home in San Fernando Valley. And when I got there, the superintendent told me if I was a good kid, I could go home on a home trip in 30 days. And God, I was good. 30 days came and went, and they loaded us on an old truck, and they brought us out of the valley, and it was an all-day trip. And they dropped us off in downtown Hollywood, and I had to run to catch the old subway car to ride downtown L.A. And had to get off in 6th and Hill to run to 6th and Main to catch the old red car to ride out to Willowbrook, where I lived. And I got off the ground running a mile and a half from my mother's house. I remember like it was yesterday, around the corner and down the street. It's all over now. No more difference than, no more apart from. I have to be around people I don't want to be around anymore. I'm going to act a certain way I don't want to act anymore. It's going to be okay. I'm going to be able to be now. It's all right. When I got to my mother's house, there was a drunken party going on there. Nothing changed except me. I spent 3.5 years in juvenile hall. I'd heard a lot of strange things. I'd heard things like everybody's a liar and everybody's a cheat. Never believe anybody used to tell me because that's a sign of weakness. Never show anybody you care for them used to tell me because that's weakness. And more important than anything else, never reach your hand up out of the gutter because the minute you do that, they come along and kick you in the teeth. I didn't want to believe that because there was something way down deep inside me that said, no, 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 it's not true. But I walked out of my mother's house that day and made a vow to myself. I lived to be 500 years old. I'd never show anybody any human emotions again. I went on the street corner and got drunk. I come home next month and got drunk again. Long about that time in my life, I was a periodic. Well, I was forced to be a periodic. They only let me out once a month, so I only got drunk once a month. It was always the same thing. I'd come home, throw a brick through a window, and get a bottle of Marco Petri red wine and drink it and get drunk and go back to school. And my first week in school was fine because I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. And my second week in school was all right because I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. My third week in school, the madness hit in because I started to think. I started thinking about showing up in the neighborhood. I started thinking about walking up to my gang. The gang wanted me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I keep saying to myself, I wonder what the gang would say if I was to tell them I didn't want to go out and hit people in the head. I wanted to go play baseball. I wonder what the gang would say if I was to tell them I didn't want to be a gangster. I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an architect, or an engineer. I wonder what they would say. But you see, if you're like me and you're nothing, and you're glued over there against the corner of the wall, and you're trying to figure out what is that magic thing that frees you from there and stands you there and gives you that, and you think about it. And somewhere during that thought process, the idea comes at the bottle of Marco Petri red wine. So you think about that and you dream about that baby and you dream about sitting down in the street corner and capping the seal and turning it up and letting that sweet, mellow thing just flow all over you, turn you into Superman. One day I opened up that gallon of wine and sit down in the street corner and drank it. I drank the whole gallon. I'm sober as I am right now. Frightened to death. My magic wasn't magic anymore. It wasn't moving me. A guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, try these. He gave me some pills. I found if I ate pills and drank wine, I could make the madness go away for a little while. It wasn't very much longer after that, sitting on the same street corner with a sack of pills and a gallon of wine, nothing was working. And the guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try this? And he gave me some morphine. I found if I put morphine in my arms and swallowed pills and drank wine, that I had a combination of things to sustain me for the next 14 years of my life. Never one, never two. It's a combination of all of them. I became too old to stay in that school. I came out in my neighborhood to become a gangster. That was my ambition in life. I wanted to be the Irish Lucky Luciano of Willowbrook. But I had a problem. I didn't stand up too often. And that's not conducive for being a gangster. You got to look alert when you're out there doing them things. You know, you just can't run and say, stick them up and puke on people. It doesn't have a ring of machoism about it. You know, when you gather up around the tough guys, you don't gather up and talk about puking. You gather up and talk about being tough. That's what we used to do in my neighborhood. We gathered up and talked about being tough. And the reason we talked about being tough is because we were frightened to death people were going to find out we weren't. That's what tough guys do. I'm going to tell you something about violence. Violence is usually a masquerade for fear. The most violent people I've ever met in my life were the most frightened people. I took all of my fear, I turned it into hostility and violence. So I knew it much easier to smack somebody before they found out how scared I was. So I put that facade up, another one. I wandered around, that's what I did. But see, I didn't have too much luck being the Lone Ranger because by the time I got ready, I was too far gone to attempt it. So I went to the gangsters and asked if I could be a gangster. And I had a reputation in my neighborhood for being a tough kid, so I went out to do some gangsters with the gangsters. And I was going to be the lookout. They come out from doing their thing, and I was getting arrested for being asleep on the curb. That's what I used to do. I used to do things like that. They gave me a reprieve one night. I was going to let me drive the getaway car, and they come out, and I was asleep with the motor running and the doors locked. That's what I used to do. I used to do things like that. Yeah, do you know why I did that? Because I was a never was. there never was a something that's so frightened or failing he doesn't try to do anything. He just sits around wherever he's at and says to himself, tomorrow I'm going to get up off this floor. Tomorrow I'm going to step out of this nut house. Tomorrow I'm going to walk out of this penitentiary. Tomorrow I'm going to be better. Tomorrow I'm going to fulfill my potential. Tomorrow I woke up sick. And tomorrow I had to get well. And that cycle went on and on and on. And the only thing that ever broke up that cycle of madness was when I got arrested. And I got arrested over and over and over again. I got arrested one time and sentenced to the United States Army. Now, I didn't want to go to the Army. I wanted to go to jail. That's where the tough guys were. But Mom wanted me to go in the Army. She wanted me to cast a shadow on the family's good name or something. I don't know what it came out of. But that's the way it went. I can't say this about the Army. I'm not eligible for the GI Bill of Rights. Because they don't pay you off for laying out in them guardhouses all the time. One good thing that happened in the Army, I had my first spiritual experience in the Army. It was in a guardhouse in Fort Lewis, Washington in a thunderstorm. And I remember it dawned upon me that night, a lack of power was my dilemma. But I thought power came in a money clip. I figured if you had enough power, they couldn't bother you. That's the rules out there. Got enough power, they can't bother you. So I came out of my neighborhood to accumulate the power. And I got all the power that you're supposed to have. I got me a big apartment building and moved into the top of it. And I got me a closet full of $300 suits. And I got me a big automobile and I parked it in the garage. And I had people coming at me at all hours of the night begging me for favors. Every once in a while, a big man would grant him a favor. The only problem was I was so frightened I couldn't leave that apartment. Because every time I did, the police jumped on me and took me to jail. But every once in a while, I used to get brave, and I'd put on one of my new suits, and I'd sneak down the back stairs about 5 o'clock in the afternoon when the people are going home from work. I'd get my big automobile, and I'd drive around places, and I'd look up at people in old beat-up pickup trucks going home from work, and I'd say to myself, I wonder what's the matter with me? Why can't I be like that guy? Why can't I just go to work and have a wife and a couple kids and a home like my older brother? What's the matter with me? Why is it this way? So I didn't have anybody around to impress about what a big man I was, and I wasn't too impressed with me anyhow. But see, I'm still hanging on to a thread of sanity. It's the last thin line between insanity and an insane person's reaction is the ability to blame something for your own actions. And I still had that kicker left. It's called God. It's God's fault. He don't like me. That's the God my grandmother talked about who punished little boys who were bad. He's been kicking me around ever since I can remember. Every once in a while I hear that nay, it scares me to death. Well, I guess if God wants me to have a job, he'll shoot one down here to the club next Thursday. Tell you how I feel about that. The next time you get hungry, go lock yourself up in a closet and pray for a hot dog. He squirts you one through the keyhole, call me. I've been looking for a deal like that all my life. You told me when I first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you want a garden, you better get you a hoe. That's the truth. There ain't no free lunches. Not for an Alky, there ain't no free lunches. Because Alkies are all born takers. And before an Alky can stay sober, he's got to quit being a taker and start being a giver. That much I do know, if I've learned nothing else in 20 years. 1951, I'm on my way to the penitentiary for the first time, and I'm standing at the visiting screen in the old Los Angeles County Jail. My mother's standing on the other side of it screaming at me that I'm a murderer. It seemed to my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison and taken an overdose of it and died. I didn't know how to handle that very well. I didn't like to handle everything else. I got mad at it. Made it go away. I remember 3 days later being handcuffed between two detectives out underneath the tree while they buried my baby brother. And I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging around me, and I'm trying to cry and I don't know how. I don't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth. The reason I don't have them is because I don't think they're necessary. I remember what I thought. I remember just as clear as I'm standing here when I thought that day. I'm thinking about this God thing again. That's all I ever used to do is think about it.
I was trying to figure out what was going on. I was trying to figure out about the God my grandmother told me about, who kicked little kids around who'd never done nothing. And I started to think about this God that the preachers used to scream at us through the bars about repenting, all is forgiven, justice. And I'm trying to figure out what kind of justice is there. What kind of justice is there in the world when you let a scum like me survive and run around the world and take a beautiful baby boy and put him in a coffin like this? Is that your justice, keeper? I went on to penitentiary. I spent 4.5 years in there, and I came out 4.5 years later trying to prove what a psychiatrist in San Quentin told me wasn't true. He said, Johnny, people like you don't change. He says, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me out and showed me the little green room one day. He said, where are you going to end up? And I told him, not me. I'm different. I come walking out of that institution, bound determined. I had a deal beaten. 6 months later, I'm laying in a nut house, kicking and screaming. When I make my round to some of the better laughing academies, interviewing psychiatrists. That's what I do when I don't have anything better to do. I talk to doctors. I sit around with my overcoat on, the wraparound one, and I talk to them. They have their glasses on their nose. They talk to me. They talk to me about my mother, and I talk to them about their mother, and they threw me out of the room. Then they took me out and wired me for sound. That'll get your attention. What do you want to know now, doctor? And then we sit there, and I did the same thing sitting there in front of this superior being. I did in front of all the superior beings. I sit there and waited for him to tell me what was wrong with me. Wanted to tell me why I had that hole in my gut, why I was different, why I was strange, why I didn't belong anywhere in the world, what planet I came from or something. Or more important, what in the God's world am I supposed to do about it? And you know what he said? Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problems. Well, that wasn't my problem. And I knew that. He didn't know that, but I knew it. See, my problem was that I was nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'd always been nothing. I was never going to be anything. I come from nothing, going nothing. And I was weird, and I had an idea that in my mind I was absolutely and totally insane. And I put something in me that made me almost. Almost. And when you felt as unworthy as I did, almost is more than you could ever hope for. Now, how do you explain to somebody sitting over here who's supposed to know who doesn't that you're nothing, and you put something in you and become almost? He's trying to tell you the elevator is the problem, and you know that the problem is that there's nothing. So when they told me that, I went on about my road. They don't know either. And 22 years ago, come February, they laid me down to bed in the Los Angeles County Jail. I weighed 128 pounds, and I was yellow. I had my left arm and my right leg tied down. A medical doctor took the foot of my bed and told me I was going to die. I told him, okay. All day passed, all night passed. He come back in my room the next morning and stood there and said the same thing to me. I told him, okay. The third day he came into my room, I had a terror grip me I've never known before since. The idea came to me that I was going to live and not die. But if you get up out of that bed and go to the penitentiary and come back out and start that rat race all over again, and God knows I didn't want to do that. So I laid there for 18 days and 18 nights. I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. Now, I thought for a long, long time that nothing happened, because there was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying we got an AA meeting down there. Little bird didn't drop the fifth chapter on my chest, and I didn't jump upon the escalator to happiness. What really happened to me that night is I went to sleep for a little while, and I started to get better. And looking back on it now, and it's been almost 22 years, I can tell you exactly what happened that night. The thing died, and I woke up. Because from that day to this day, my life had been in a different direction. Now, I didn't know that, but it has. I can look back and see it just as clear as I can see you. It ain't been the same. And what was different about it, I just couldn't do it anymore. I don't know if that makes any sense to you or not. All my life I've been playing games and playing roles and snapping my fingers and talking out of the corner of my mouth and yeah, boo-hoo. And I just didn't have the strength to play that silly game anymore. I just didn't want to be it anymore. And I can stand in front of a Superior Court judge being sentenced to 20 years in the penitentiary. That don't mean anything to me. That's a game I played. You win some, you lose some. Things important that you get your turn at bat. I turned to walk out of the courtroom that day. The judge said something to a lady who was sitting in the courtroom that literally almost drove me insane. He said to her, "Lady, if you care anything at all about the child you carry inside of you, you get so far away from this scum, you'll never be allowed to lay eyes on him. He's a blood-sucking parasite in society. He doesn't have any right being around decent people. But in my power, he ain't ever going to be." And I'm walking out of the courtroom saying to myself, he's not talking about me. He's talking about my old man and my uncles and my grandfather. But he was talking about me, and I knew he was talking about me. He put into words that day what I had spent an entire lifetime trying to hide from the world, what I really was in here. And as far as I could put that together, that is the ungrounded, unnamed fear of the alcoholic. The fear of exposure of what we really are in here, where we live. You see, the evidence was so damning that I couldn't stand to look at anybody anymore because I couldn't play them silly games anymore. I spent the next 9 months of my life locked up in solitary confinement, barking at the moon. And that's the way I was when I stumbled into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 20 years ago, the first Sunday of last month. Now, I don't take any credit for coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, nor do I take any credit for being here or staying here or not putting anything in me in those 20 years. Because if I'd have known where I was coming 20 years ago, I wouldn't even have come. That's simple. I know how to put it. You know why I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Because the institution I was in allowed women to come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around here ever since. I don't care what gets them in here. I never will forget my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope I don't ever forget it, really. Because it's been written somewhere by somebody far wiser than I am. That if you forget it, you're condemned to relive it. And I don't ever want to forget my first meeting. Because I came in with my coat collar up and my shades on, because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have froze to death, for God's sake. And I sit down in the back row on what I lovingly like to call my throne of contempt. I looked up on the backboard and I saw two big A's, and I thought to myself, my God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. I said to this clown sitting next to me, "What is this?" He said, "It's Alcoholics Anonymous." I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. If they'd been Gangsters Anonymous or Weirdos Anonymous or Dopies Anonymous, yeah, I'd have been up there. But it was Alcoholics. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what one was, but I didn't want to be one. I had an idea. It's what my old man was. I did a lifetime trying to be better than that bunk. My old man didn't walk along and drag his leg and talk out of the corner of his mouth. He wasn't too hip. He'd never been to penitentiary, but he wasn't hip. He was just a lame, my old man. I remember my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because that was the meeting that I saw the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is its people. Make no mistake about that. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is its people. Without the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, there would be no evidence of the miracle that transpires within these rooms. But what I saw that day, I saw people get up at a podium with dancing eyes and smiling faces, and he radiated something about him that I didn't understand. I understand it today, what it was. For the first time in my entire lifetime, I gazed upon people who were at peace with themselves, but there weren't any wars going on inside of them. There wasn't any violence there. And you see, I came out of a world where there was no peace. In my neighborhood, there weren't any peaceful people who were happy. They were all violent, hostile, angry people in my neighborhood. Right away, these people ruined it. They started talking about God. When I came here and you talked to me about God, I got up and ran out of the room. But I kept coming back to your meeting because seeing you had seen a miracle, and I didn't know that. Now, I got up one Sunday morning. Don't ask me what Sunday morning it was, because I don't know. But I do know it was my day. It's the day I spent my lifetime waiting to happen. Everything that I'd ever done in my life had driven me right up to the very gates of hell that morning. I had no way of knowing that I was going to go sit down in a room and somebody was going to put the key into the gates of hell, open up, and let me out of there. I didn't know that. If I'd had that knowledge when I'd woken up that morning, I wouldn't have went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, because I wasn't conditioned to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings for answers. I was conditioned to go to the quote-unquote experts in life, the doctors and the preachers and the teachers and the lawyers and the judges and the counselors and all those people. I wasn't conditioned to go to drunks for answers. I was conditioned to go to the experts for answers. And to show you how truthful that was, they never had them. And they still don't have them. They still don't. But not knowing, not armed with that knowledge, I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that afternoon. And I said, well, I sat in the back row with my coat collar up and my shades on. A little guy that I knew did 23 fat years in the penitentiary stood at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and told me something I've never forgotten. It makes more sense to me than anything that I know. It makes more sense to me tomorrow than anything I'll ever learn. He said to me, you just don't have to live this way no more if you don't want to. He says, you don't have to do it like this no more. You know, nobody ever told me that. People have been telling me all my life, don't drink, swallow, smoke, and shoot. But they never told me how to live without doing. How do you live in that rotten world out there that you don't belong to? I want no part of you, and you don't want any part of it. And the only thing that makes it almost bearable is something you put in you. After this meeting, I ran up to this little guy, and I said, how do you learn how to live? He looked at me and smiled. He said, Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. Think. If you go home and get it, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in that book. Now, I guess that little guy's prayed real hard, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I found in that book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. See, I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world. I'm not looking for a way to cure all society's ills either. What I'm looking for is a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. Now, I'm going to tell you about the strange phenomena that takes place in my life. It seemed like to me that the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in that book, and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. That's a strange phenomenon that takes place in my life. And I fought Alcoholics Anonymous tooth and nail when I came here, because I was so different. I was just different. There weren't any people like me in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here. I was weird. I just wasn't like them. When I used to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd hear them say things like, you've got to get active in AA. And I'd get up and run around like a chick with my head cut off. I didn't know what active was. You've got to pick up ashtrays and pour coffee and smile at people. And pick up ashtrays and pour coffee and smile. It's wonderful, right? Welcome to AA. It's wonderful. Happy, happy, happy. Wonderful. I'd go back and sit in the corner and die. Because I still had the madness. I still had the uneasiness. And I was apart from. I wasn't a part of AA. I couldn't identify. They would say, you keep coming, you'll hear your story. And I used to try to listen to the things that people did. They'd come in with stories I'm listening to. The guy, yeah, I used to drink. I don't drink anymore. Now I'm wonderful. I said, oh, God. I put the plug in the jug, and my seat in the seat, and the world's been wonderful for 20 years. I didn't check his prescription that day, but I should have. So I just didn't understand that. Then he'd tell me stories like, I used to drink, and then I'd get sober and put my business together, my family together, then everything would get together. Then I'd drink, and it'd all go, and I'd say, God, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. My problem always started when I was sober, not when I was drinking. That's when the madness came about me. I just mad, and I was restless and irritable and at ease, and I hated everything, and I just couldn't wait to get something inside of me. So maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe I'm just weird. And I used to read that book and throw it across the room because nothing happened. And one day I went over and picked it up and looked down and saw the most simple statement I'd ever seen in my life. It said, how it works. Which, you know, I almost missed that. Right behind that thing in the preamble that was read here tonight. It tells you exactly in the first two or three sentences of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in chapter 5 who makes our program and who doesn't. Very simply. And I sit around in a book study meeting, I don't know how you have, a bunch of people that I'm very close to all of a sudden start coming up loaded. They just coming up loaded. And you hear all kinds of stories. Well, you got wrapped up with Mary. Mary did that. And I couldn't see. I never seen anybody drink Mary. I never saw that. I didn't get materially minded here. I got materially minded here. I got the new car, and I think, God, I just couldn't picture somebody putting a car in his arm or something. I just couldn't do that. It just never computed. And I didn't say, oh, I just couldn't compute that. I just couldn't do that. I just never figured out it had something to do with what was going on out there. And one night I'm sitting in a little book study meeting I go to every Wednesday night, and they read the fifth chapter, almost knocked me out of my seat. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Period. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? Well, there's no great mystery to me about who makes our program and who doesn't. Not anymore. Now I know. Because the book told me so. See, I fought Alcoholics Anonymous tooth and nail. I found it necessary when I could find in that institution to do the things that are required of me to do. I found myself one time still ill at ease and apart from with a tablet and a pencil writing out an inventory. I got to spend 3.5 hours telling a man about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life, and in that 3.5 hours I'm sitting out underneath the tree hearing the birds sing. Green grass growing under my hand, and that feeling of freedom that came about me that I carry with me today, and a peacefulness and ease. Never, that was the real miracle. The real miracle was the following night or the next night, whenever it was, I went to my meeting, and by some strange thing, I had moved as a part from to a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. By attempting to fulfill the conditions of this program, I was no longer a part from Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a part of. It has been my great pleasure from that day to this day to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings all over the North American continent. And if I didn't know where I was half the time, I wouldn't know where I was. That's the truth. Because I'm part of AA. And I had that explained to me a couple, 3 years ago when I was in Hawaii. There's a guy got up at the podium and he's going to introduce me. This guy was about 6'8", weighed 4,000 pounds. He was a lion. He was a big guy. And he got up there and he's standing there and he said, just because you go sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous does not make you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous anymore, and going sitting in a chicken coop would make you a chicken. By God, that's true. That is true. Because before I became willing to fulfill the conditions of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been a part of it ever since, so that's true. Strange things started happening to me after I started to fulfill the conditions of this program. 18.5 years ago, I came out of that penitentiary. 19 years now. I went home, my mother fell off steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch and said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, fine, I think you should. It took my mother a long time to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very proud tonight to tell you, when she's sober, she goes to meetings. Now, she don't stay sober all the time, but that's not any of my business. I learned a great lesson from my mother, the greatest lesson I've ever learned. I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober. I am powerless. I'm as powerless today as I was 25 years ago. I ain't got any power. Well, God, I would tell them what I've got is a daily reprieve, period. And that's only conditioned among my maintenance of certain spiritual conditions. Now, I don't know what spiritual conditions mean to you. But what it means to me is that I can't do anything you can't watch. That's what spiritual conditions mean to me. It means that I got to live my life like that guy lived it 2,000 years ago, as close to it as I can. You get a lot of flack that way. So we ain't saints. Yeah, but there's a line that says we grow along spiritual lines. That says we got to grow. That means we can't just keep our feet firmly planted in garbage forever. Just because we ain't got nothing making our heads screwed up, don't mean that we can't still stand in a pile of stink. What it means to me is that if I continue to live sober the way I live drunk, I got to get drunk again. It's just as simple as I know how to put it. I got a friend down there in L.A. and he lives in Venice. He says very well, because he's kind of like I am, a little nutty. He says that alcoholics stay sober for as long as they can stand it. Then they get drunk as long as they can stand that. And so I guess what that really means is that I had to find some kind of way to live peacefully and comfortably where I wouldn't have to drink anymore. I guess I have to learn to live in this world in such an area and such a state of comfort that it isn't necessary for me to get comfortable in here anymore. I don't have to put anything in here to make me comfortable anymore, because most of the time it's comfortable. Now, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I first started to fill the conditions of program recovery, I used to get a couple of good days. I wonder, what's the matter? Wonder what's the matter. Something feels wrong. Well, I was feeling good. You see, I'm so used to feeling bad that feeling good was weird. Now, the strange thing that's happened is that during the 20-year period of time, that's reversed. Now, if I start feeling bad, it's weird. I do something about it. I wonder what's the matter. Well, what are you doing? Well, I'm going about my business. It's amazing. Now, I came out of the penitentiary and everything got good. God got through. I got a job. Well, first my wife came back. Went and got my little girl I was never supposed to see. Then she got pregnant. Then I got a job. Well, they didn't pay you off in those days for being a hot dog. They didn't pay you off for staying out of the penitentiary. You know, they went and showed my parole officer and said, you better try to pass that nailing test. That's all they ever said. You got a job? There's no way to get your job or go back to jail. Well, I tell them one time, can you help me? He says, help you hell, get your own job. I got a job. I went down one time and got a job working in the oil fields. Now, that's not very good work for a big high roller, but it paid well. I remember one night I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think Willie was there. And I spent all day working on that oil field, and been busting pipe out of a hole with a big 36-inch pipe wrench, and I didn't have enough money to afford gloves. And my hands were all cracked and bloody and bleeding, and I stood at the point of Alcoholics Anonymous at night and started crying. I looked down and saw my hands were bleeding. And I was crying because for the first time in my life, I was fulfilling my obligations to the world as a human being. I was asking nothing. I was contributing. I was earning my own way through life. If you haven't experienced that thing, I think it's something you're not supposed to miss. I was earning and taking care of me and mine. I worked and worked, and I used to watch people. I didn't know anything. I used to watch what people did because I'd never experienced these things. I'd watch them. I'd go to markets and I'd see how daddies would push a little girl down the baskets and things like that. When I got my first paycheck, I ran home and got the wife and put her in the car and put the baby in the car. I said, we're going to market. So I said, I want to push her down the aisle in that basket like I've seen them daddies do. We went down and pushed them around the aisle of the market, you know, I did all that stuff. We went home, and an hour later, I went to ask my wife for some money to go get a haircut. And somebody stole her purse. So if you want to hear somebody scream, you ought to hear a thief when they get stolen from. I went up and down, around, about. I screamed and hollered and walked up and down. I tell you, if I could have found the guy, I wouldn't be here. Very serene it was. I got all through. I went in and sat down. She poured me a cup of coffee. She says, you all through? And I says, yeah. She says, now you know how it feels. You know what happened, though? That afternoon I went to work. And I've been working ever since. And I haven't missed any more paychecks. Nobody stole it. Life got pretty good. Life got real good and my 6 year rolled around. What happened in my 6 year of sobriety outside of the penitentiary, I'll share with you because it happens to most people. And I'll call it sound. It seems how that some a very subtle thing happened to me. It's so subtle that it'll kill you before you even know you got a hold of it, and it damn near killed me. What happened was that the values of that world slowly but surely superimposed the values of this world. It became more important for me to have something and to drive something and to wear something and to spin something than it was to be nothing. See? And so I got a big car and I'm living in a big house in Lakewood. I got two cars in the garage and I got a closet full of suits and I'm buried in debt. And I go to meetings, I park my new car at the door and people say, "How you doing?" I say, "See my new car?" They say, "How you doing?" I say, "See my new suit of clothes?" I say, "How you doing?" I say, "Easy does it. First things first. Live and let live. I never had it so good, but for the grace of God, amen, amen." And I'm lying. I'm dying in my shoes because I got to leave the meeting and I got to go back out into that real world out there. And I got to go to that real world and I go home to this house I lived in. It's empty and I got to wander around the neighborhood to find this gal and find these two kids of ours. And I put them in the car and drive around the bars to find their mother. And I'm taking around these bars 1, 2, or 3 o'clock in the morning. I got to work the next morning, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm trying to tell her, "Well, why do you do these things?" I say, "Well, what's the matter with you? Why? Why don't you just come here? If you got a drinking problem, why don't you just sit down? I'm drunk. I'm an Al-Anon." I say, "Oh, wait a minute. You know, why do you do this?" And she said, "You're a drag. That's why I do it." I said, "Oh, I don't understand." She asked, "All you want to do is work and go to those meetings and stay with your kids. I want to go out and dance and listen to the music and have fun. If you come go with us, you can drink Cokes. You know I don't even like Cokes, but I thought about doing it. Matter of fact, I came very close to doing it because I was so far out of it. But I wasn't. And one morning I got up, I told this woman that I lived with that something had to change. I didn't like to live her life. She wasn't going to live my life. One of us was going to have to leave. It looked like it was going to be me. And I went on to work, and an hour later they came out and pulled me off the job and told me she took her own life. I didn't handle that very well either. I found myself a few months later living in a $60 a month rented room in East Long Beach. And I don't understand what's going on. I'm working 14, 16 hours a day trying to pay off these debts. I don't know what's going on. I'm living down there and I got a piece of bologna in my icebox and a half a jar of instant coffee. My kids are staying someplace they ain't supposed to be, and I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sitting in the back row with my coat collar up and my shades on, my air of contempt about me, and Charlie Wonderful jumped at the podium. So I got here 90 days ago, and my car is brand new, and my business is flourishing, my wife is back, and I say, "Good God, when am I going to get mine? Look what I've done here. I've gone and gone and did and did, and here he is." Wonder what, you know how sick that is? Can you understand how very sick that is? I'm sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, expecting to be rewarded for receiving a gift. Do you realize how sick that is? My gift is sobriety and this way of life. There one night I was in a meeting and the man who was my sponsor was there. He was talking. He wasn't my sponsor then, but he was a dear friend. When he was talking about that meeting, he was talking about his wife and his kids and his job and his home and all them kind of things. It made me very uncomfortable. And after the meeting, I ran up to him to shake his hand just because that's what you're supposed to do, and I couldn't get to him because there's a crowd of people around him. I started to walk out the door, and he saw me out of the corner of his eye, I guess. He came over and got me, and he put his arms around me, and he hugged me. And he don't hug very easy, but he hugged me, and he said things crazy to me. He said, "Gee, Johnny, God must love you a great deal." And I promptly told him I didn't think God loved me at all. He says, "Yeah, he never gives any more we can handle, and those who got the bigger load got to be the blessed." Then I promptly told him I don't want to be blessed anymore either. And then he said something to me I didn't understand, and I probably still don't understand it fully. He said, "Remember, if he gives big crosses to big hosses, he gives little crosses to guys named John." I went home that night, and I found myself down somewhere I hadn't been for a long time on my knees because I'd become too big to pray. And I said a little prayer that I say every day of my life, and prayer is this, God, relieve me from the bondage of self, that I may be witness to those who see of your undying mercy and love on me. And I got up, and it seemed like to me I've been walking towards the sunshine ever since. Shortly thereafter, I'm walking through a picnic ground in the, at an AA picnic, and a little blue-eyed angel gave me a piece of chicken. I want you to know that's the most expensive piece of chicken I've ever ate. But it is also the most nourishing food for the fulfillment of my fulfillment in life that I've ever morsed. Because you brought to my life a dimension that's never been there before. And it's still there. And the only sad thing I have about coming to places like this is I have to leave her for a little while. We've been together almost 12 years now. She's raised my children. Life is good. Life is extremely good. I couldn't explain it to you and tell you how good it is. You know that little girl I've never supposed to see? The one that the superior person told me I couldn't be around? I raised her. I raised her. And a year ago, last October, there was a phone call from a Marine sergeant in a hospital in Orange County telling my daughter was in the hospital going to have a baby. She wouldn't go into the operating room if her father wasn't there. And I ran over there to that hospital and sit there with my son-in-law while my daughter gave birth to a little baby boy. Three weeks ago last night, she came down to attend the homecoming of her high school. And she brought little Jim with him. He's a year old now. He ran all over the house. He ran me till I couldn't run anymore, and I got in bed. So Dottie had to go to a meeting, and there was nobody to babysit but little Jim but me. And then he chased the dogs till the dogs couldn't run anymore, and the dogs got in bed with him. And he lay down on the floor and kicked a little while till he gave out, and I put him up in bed with me. And I got him and the two dogs in bed with me, and I'm laying there, and I'm crying me a river. Because that ain't supposed to be, you see. I ain't even supposed to have that little boy, let alone be able to take care of him. And my daughter and her husband and everybody just took off and left me with that little baby boy. Clown like me. People wouldn't even leave their dogs near me before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Matter of fact, if they saw me coming, they'd get shotguns out and say, get away from here. And my daughter brings that little boy there. My life is full of grace. The girl that's never seen me drink, my daughter. Then my 17-year-old who's been born to me since I've been an alcoholic, now what a young lady she's become. Life is good. Now, if there's two things in life I love to do besides go to meetings and stay home, it's play golf. And a few years ago, a company that I belonged to bought me a membership in a country club. And I'm out there playing golf one Wednesday with a couple of doctors. And I got a short sleeve shirt on, and I got things on my arms like daggers through skulls with blood dripping from them, and panthers with their sides shot out, and crosses with little dots. Everybody in the club's got one, but it just, and I'm wandering down the fairway, and the doctor said to me, he said, gee, Johnny, you sure have big forearms. And I said, oh. He says, yeah, did you ever play baseball? I used to play ball every time I went to jail. He went, oh. You've never been in jail. And I didn't tell him any different, because that ain't my deal. I don't have to tell him I was bad, now I'm magnificent. I don't have to elevate myself above, you know, he wouldn't blame any of that stuff. I just let him go on about my business. And see, I know this little fellow pretty good right now. And I played golf with him a couple times a week for the last couple of years. He's a doctor, and I've got to talk to him and know him and love him very much. He's a nice little guy. You see, I just found out this little guy worked and studied and sacrificed all of his life for himself through school. He worked and sacrificed and studied for himself through medical school. He worked and said, he had nothing else, nobody else to do anything for him. And he worked and he sacrificed through internship and through his medical practice. And he finally got successful. He bought him a house and joined the country club. That's his deal. Now, how do I tell this little guy that did all this? I spent my entire lifetime running up and down the street, shooting dope, beating people, going in and out of penitentiaries and nut houses, and got sober and ended up the same place he did. What do you think he'd say? Well, I know what he'd say. It ain't possible. You've got to earn this life, the good life, you know? You just have to look at him and say, But I've been given here as a gift. A gift from a loving father to an undeserving child, really. Because I did nothing to merit or warrant the life that's mine. Nothing at all. And I'd like to tell you something that happened to me in this meeting when I was here last time. I'd like to share it with you because to me it says so much that I can't hardly think about San Jose without thinking about it. I've told this story all over the United States. Last time I was here, I don't think we were in this room, we were someplace. And I'm standing over at the corner and I guess they brought a busload of a bunch of them kids from one of those drug recovery houses or something, I don't know. And this one kid is sitting there, he's the hip with the ball of his feet tickling when he walks. He's sitting over there and he had long hair and mustache and all that kind of stuff. And he really was hip or fixture and kept watching me. And I'm standing over there in the coffee corner drinking coffee. And finally come over to me and he said, are you Johnny Harris? And I said, yes, I am. He says, you don't look like him. I said, what does he look like? He said, well, I don't know, man. He said, I've been listening to your tape for 6 months. He said, you just don't look like that. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you just don't look like that. I said, well, if I talked out of the corner of my mouth, wore my hair long, a big mustache, wore Levi's and combat boots, and said mother every other time, would that fit the picture? He said, yeah. And I said, you don't seem to understand, young man. I live by a spiritual program, on spiritual growth. You elevate yourself out of that pile of garbage. You become something better than that. You move to a better evidence that we grow along spiritually. He says, the hell you say? I said, yeah. He shuffled on back to his seat and he sat there. And I did my thing and he left. And you never know. A few months later, I'm deplaced into Reno at an AA deal. And I walk in there on Saturday night to talk at the meeting, and I go up to get my coffee like I always do, and I turn around, and they're sitting in the front row with this kid. He said... So I went over there with him. He had his hair cut. He was clean-shaven. He had a nice pair of slacks on, a nice shirt, two pair of shoes. He said, I just want to let you know that I belong to the same spiritual program that you do. And I can't tell you what that means to me. I just can't tell you what that story means to me. What you are speaks so loud, I can't hear a word you say. Example of what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous can do for you is the greatest thing. Now, I'd like to talk to you about gratitude. Because I only know one way to talk about gratitude. You hear it in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. I'm grateful, grateful, grateful. I'm very thankful for this thing of life of mine called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm thankful for everything that's happened to me. I'm thankful for the life that's mine, for the guy that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, for the ability to give and receive love and to know joy. I'm very thankful for the peace that's been blessed upon me in abundance and the serenity that lives in my life most of the time. I'm very thankful for the things that have come to me through the effort to work. I'm very thankful for a lot of things. Gratitude is something that you do. Gratitude is the action that you take to put back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, what you've been taken out of. So I'd rather see somebody do something than to hear them tell me how grateful they are. I've heard a lot of people stand at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous like this and tell you how grateful they are, and they won't even pick up their own coffee cup when they get ready to leave the meeting. Be thankful for this program. Be grateful in the things you do. Do something in this thing. I've come to understand that doing something in this thing is the most reward that any human being can ever get. This is the only place. This is what this is for people like me and you, I hope. It's our one opportunity in life to put back into life what's been given to us. We can do in here what we can't do anywhere else. We can share our experience, strength, and hope in here with one another in love. And by the very healing grace of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, we can rise above a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot crawling around on the floor in solitary confinement. So that's what gratitude is. Somebody I loved much, very much a long time ago was dying, and I went to a hospital. It's here. And she was in a deep coma, and I sit there on the bed, and I'm crying like a baby because I don't want her to die without me telling her thank you. I want to thank her for this thing that she'd given to me and called Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how to thank her. And I'm sitting there and I'm crying and I kept saying to her, oh God, Mom, how do I thank you? And she looked up at me for an instant, her eyes cleared. It was the most magnificent sight I've ever seen. And she said these very simple words to me. She said, sweetheart, there's only one way in God's world that you can ever express your gratitude in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's remained a good example of what this program can do for you. And I hope and pray to God I always will. Thank you.